This Civic Media podcast is sponsored by UW Organ and Tissue Donation. Organ donations are desperately needed, and now is the right time to become an organ donor. Talk to your family. Get the dot. Save lives. Go to heroicdeed.com.
Broadcasting across the state of Wisconsin on the Civic Media Radio Network and around the world on the Civic Media app, this is the Dom Salvia Show. And now, here's your host, Dom Salvia.
Welcome back. It's the Dom Salvia Show here on Civic Media. I'm Jimmy Cuska filling in again today. I'll be out of the way tomorrow. We'll have a new guest host. Dr. Tim Slecker will take over. He hosts the Busted Pencils podcast, somebody very familiar to Jess P.S. and I, as Jess is also the producer for that podcast, and I'm a pretty frequent guest of that program to talk high school sports. But Dr. Slecker will take you through the 4 to 6 hour, 2 hours, that is, tomorrow here on the Dom Salvia Show. Still have an hour to go today. Again, coming up at 6, it's Nightlight with Pete Schwabba. In a half an hour, we're going to talk about what it takes to get on the ballot in a local election. A spring election is coming up on April 1st, but the deadlines to get things in are coming in here in the next couple of weeks. In fact, January 7th is the deadline to get paperwork in to run for local office. And we're going to talk about it from a school board perspective, as many school board races are up for election. We're going to talk about that with the executive director of the Wisconsin Association of School Boards, Dan Ross Miller. If you're just joining us in the first hour, we did cover the latest on what's happening in Madison with the tragic school shooting in Madison at Abundant Life Christian School. And we will have more news updates on that throughout our network. If you listen in our news windows, we'll have plenty of coverage on Civic Media for that throughout. But right now, we are going to turn our attention to another news story that came throughout the weekend and talking a bit about gas prices and, of course, the oil spill that just happened here in Wisconsin. And we're going to do that right now. I'm joined right now by Patrick DeHaan. He's the head of petroleum analysis at Gas Buddy, and we are talking all things gas prices, oil, everything you can imagine here. Patrick, thank you for joining me here today.
Thanks for having me.
So obviously, the big news in Wisconsin over the weekend that came out was that there was an oil spill in Jefferson County. 77,000 gallons of oil apparently estimated to be spilled there. So I'm going to lead with this because I'm curious. Do these oil spills affect gas prices, you know, in an area, in a region, in a state? Do they have any impact on what happens with gas prices?
They really don't. The thing to monitor here in a situation like this is the spill size. I mean, obviously, if we're talking about a massive spill and this pipeline is completely severed, then that would be a challenge because pipelines generally carry oil to refineries. So, you know, in a situation like this, the spill is quite small. It was reported as 1,650 barrels. You may see various reports that simply quantify that into gallons, which would be about 69,000 gallons of oil. But simply because the way things are measured, it's about 1,700 barrels. And, you know, the average refinery in the U.S. can handle about 200,000 barrels a day. So about 1,700 barrels is pretty small for, you know, impacting the price of oil. So this will have no impact on oil prices at all.
Just to follow up on that, this was an Enbridge line six that had the spill. And I think a lot of people in Wisconsin know, and I actually had talked about this on Friday, that there's an ongoing fight in northern Wisconsin over line five and permitting for that. There were two lawsuits filed last week. So now when it comes to policy and pipelines and things like that, you know, if they were to close off, say, you know, construction of a pipeline in northern Wisconsin or in the upper Midwest, because these fights have been happening in Michigan and Minnesota as well.
Yeah.
Do those have impacts on oil prices?
Oh, absolutely. You know, watching the line five feud between Michigan and Enbridge is really interesting. I mean, there's significant repercussions here on the state of Michigan, because that line five is what primarily feeds refineries down in Detroit. The Marathon refinery in Detroit also goes over into Sarnia, Ontario, where there are more refineries. And it also goes down to Toledo, Ohio, where there are more refineries. And shutting down line five would be huge, catastrophic to those refineries. And by the way, this line six, well, at least line 6B, carries roughly 667 1,000 barrels of oil per day. So to put the 1,650 barrels into context, that is less than 1/5 of 1 percentage point of the amount of oil this pipeline carries. So it there's big potential there, but this is relatively small. And, you know, pipelines are the safest by far, even with the spill included, are the safest, most efficient ways to get the amount of oil to where it needs to go.
Talking to Patrick DeHaan of Gas Buddy, one of the articles I was posted here last week was talking about oil production in the United States. And, you know, I think that if you're my age, you know, getting into the middle ages, you know, thinking about where gas comes from, I think a lot of people might think like, well, you know, a lot of the gas is coming, or a lot of the oil and gas are coming from, you know, overseas. But last week, it appears the United States may have set a record high for oil production.
Yeah, weekly estimates are a little bit less reliable because it's really difficult to get all the latest numbers reliable. So these are weekly estimates. They do change after the fact. But yeah, last week, the Energy Information Administration, that is under the Department of Energy, estimated the weekly U.S. oil production hit 13.6 million barrels a day. That would be an all-time record. It's been slowly going back up since the pandemic caused a lot of oil production to shut down. So over the last 3 years, that number has continued to go up. It was 10, it was 11, then 12. Now we're at 13.6. We are by far the world's largest oil producer. In fact, Saudi Arabia, second place, roughly 8.5 to 9 million barrels a day. Russia may have actually overtaken them right now. So by far, by over 3 million barrels, the U.S. is the world's largest oil producer.
And Patrick, I bring this up because in the context of things happening politically, we just talked about some of the local fights we're having here in Wisconsin and some of the issues here. But when you talk about, you know, United States policy, foreign policy, with an incoming administration that is talking about placing tariffs on other countries, including the borders to the United States and Canada and Mexico, how would those things affect gas prices?
Well, here's the important thing to understand is that while the U.S. is a huge producer of crude oil, we don't have pipelines built, right, to mirror today's dynamics for oil markets. Meaning that, keep in mind, the U.S. oil production surge, that's happened in the last 10 or 15 years, right? The way we have built pipelines have responded to decades and decades of oil market shifting dynamics. So to say that, refineries here in the Great Lakes don't process a whole lot of U.S. crude oil. Why? Well, because pipelines were built decades and decades ago to a reliable, stable supply of oil from Canada. And refineries have been targeting more and more of that Canadian oil because, by the way, we get it at a huge discount because Canada's oil can't generally get to the international marketplace. So we've been absorbing that Canadian oil, and we've generally been buying at a far lower price because Canada really can't sell to the international marketplace. And that's why refineries over the last decades, like the BP refinery in Northwest Indiana back in 2008, expanded to process more Canadian crude oil. So that's the dynamic here. A lot of people don't understand. And so having a tariff on Canadian oil, which is the primary oil we refine here in the Great Lakes, that would have a catastrophic impact on the type of oil that refineries here in our region are paying. And that's why it would be passed down to us, because these refineries, I mean, it's like going to a restaurant and saying, no, you pay the higher cost of food. No, that's not how it works. Restaurants pass that along to the end consumer. Oil companies would be forced to do the same, or I should say refineries would be forced to do the same, because they're simply buying that oil and turning it into something that you want. And so that's why tariffs could be very catastrophic, especially on Canadian crude oil, because we receive over 4 million barrels of Canadian crude oil every single day.
And it sounds like those impacts would be felt pretty painfully here in the Midwest if that were to come to pass, right?
Definitely the Midwest and Rockies. These are the two regions of the country that have long had stable access and pipelines that flow directly down from Canada. And that's why the Great Lakes and Rockies would be much more affected by this tariff potentially than anyone else.
So if the tariffs did come into play, does that affect like the need for some of the pipelines and things that are going on in, you know, like in Wisconsin? Because I know that we're talking about a lot of environmental permitting and things like that. That's where the fight is right now. But if there are tariffs and all of a sudden that changes demand, is there still a need for the pipelines?
Yeah, I mean, there'd be a huge shift, I mean, never before have we seen basically the system that has worked, right? The status quo for decades could suddenly massively change overnight if Trump implements these massive tariffs, because 25% is a huge, I mean, imagine if you're a business operator and your cost of your main component of what you produce is going up 25%. I mean, you're going to be, alarm bells are going off, things are going to change. So the flow of oil could, in theory, change, but to what limit? I mean, oil pipelines can't just reverse very easily. It does take time. And oil companies, well, some of them may be in a better position to change the type of oil that they're using. So there could be a lot of things that kind of tear and break apart before they're put back together again. But it would cause a massive shift, and it would take time for the market to absorb those changes.
Patrick DeHaan is from Gas Buddy. This is something we report on every week, is just kind of the change in gas prices and things like that. We'll spin it to a lighter topic now, because there's a lot of things that happen, you know, politically that it takes a lot to kind of wrap your head around. But I do want to talk more generally about, you know, what people are kind of asking this time of year with the holidays next week for many mm-hmm. folks, just kind of where things are trending and where things are at. I know that here where I'm at in Western Wisconsin, things have been pretty stable for, it feels like, months now. But I'm curious about kind of the trends in holiday gas prices as we get closer and closer to the week that many people celebrate.
Well, I mean, yeah, you know, it's been a good time of year if you're a motorist. Thanksgiving was terrific. Gas prices have been low, as you said, for quite some time. I mean, looking at Wisconsin's average, going back the last 6 months, we have not seen gas prices really above $3 a gallon since October. That's the last time the Wisconsin state average was above $3 a gallon. And it's been a pretty good year. I mean, compared to 2022, the average price for gasoline this year in Wisconsin peaked at about $3.51 a gallon in July. And it's been below $3 a gallon, as I mentioned, for the last, month and a half. And it probably will stay below $3 a gallon for most of the winter. Now, there could be some issues, and obviously tariffs, that is a potential wild card. But we're finally kind of back on track. We've mended from COVID. We've mended from the impact that Russia's war in Ukraine is having. Oil has still found a place in the market. And keep in mind, China is a big part of the story. China's the second largest oil consumer globally. China's economy is in a bit of a rut, and that's given gas prices a break here because Chinese demand is much lower. So, you know, we're going to continue to see gas prices below $3 a gallon, probably for the next, we'll call it 4 to 8 weeks. If something happens, that could obviously cause gas prices to go back above $3 a gallon. But the next big increase in prices is going to be the seasonal rise that we see late next winter, early spring, when Americans start getting back out after, you know, 8 weeks of winter. And that's when demand goes up and we start switching back to summer gasoline. And I'm hopeful that 2025 will be fairly similar to 2024, if not maybe a little lower in terms of prices.
Patrick, last thought for you. If people want to learn more, find out how to check gas prices, things like that, where can they go?
Well, they can always download the Gas Buddy app to their iPhone or Android. And of course, I would encourage that, because even with gas prices relatively low in Wisconsin today, the Gas Buddy app will show you where that cheapest station in Wisconsin, by the way, 247 at a wholesale club just outside Milwaukee. So there's a lot lower price, and that's 30 cents a gallon lower than the statewide average. So check that out. I'm Gas Buddy Guy on X or Blue Sky or whatever social media platform. There's a lot more information out there if you're interested.
Patrick, I appreciate all your time and insights. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Again, Patrick DeHaan from Gas Buddy. We'll talk a little bit more about this coming up next on the Dom Salvia Show here on Civic Media.
You're listening to Civic Media. You can tune into any of our live shows on any radio station across the state with the Civic Media app. Find us in your phone's app store and listen anytime, anywhere.
Welcome back here to the Dom Salvia Show on Civic Media stations across Wisconsin. I'm Jimmy Cuska. Thank you for joining us today. Had a great conversation just a couple of minutes ago with Patrick DeHaan. He's from GasBuddy.com, which is a pretty cool tool that lets you find the cheapest gas in town. I have four gas stations in the city I live in, and all four of them have different prices. So for me, it's an eyeball test. You look out the window, you look left for the one, you look right for the three, and then you just pick the lowest prices, right? But it's amazing when you consider, especially in the more rural parts of the state, where you can be in one town and gas is 30 cents cheaper than the neighboring town just because of, you know, which person is running the gas to which city, you know, what highway you're on, et cetera, how close you are to, you know, a state border, whether it's Minnesota or Michigan or Iowa or Illinois. It is fascinating, gas prices. And obviously all that insight we share in our newscasts every week with the trends and the updates on it. But it was interesting in that I had booked Patrick last week before we found out about the oil spill in Jefferson County. So when I talked to him this morning, that was what I started talking to him about, was, you know, an oil spill, because that's a pretty big deal. And for me, just seeing the news headline saying 70,000 gallons spilled, and you know, however that converts to liters, because that's an even bigger number. And it's like a never ending series of like, what number sounds the biggest and scariest, I guess, for a news headline, because you want people to click on it, right? You need people to read it. And we settled in at barrels, because that's how oil production and shipping is measured. And it provided a pretty good deal of context to how much oil actually spilled in Jefferson County. And just PR-wise, it probably couldn't have come at a more difficult time right now for Enbridge, which is trying to secure its permits that have been approved by the DNR for its Line 5 pipeline in northern Wisconsin. This was a subject I actually had covered on Friday during this show with our northwestern Wisconsin reporter, James Kelly, talking about the lawsuits that are happening up in northwestern Wisconsin, where the tribe and an advocacy group have sued to try to delay the permits being issued, try to give them more time to counter what the DNR did in improving it. For the groups that are suing, saying that the DNR didn't have enough information to make the approvals, didn't do enough to study the environmental impacts by rerouting this upstream of the Bad River Reservation. And that's, and you know, so that's playing out in court. As we've seen now in all of our northern Midwestern states, with Minnesota and the Line 3 issues, with Michigan, as they're dealing now with the Line 5 part of it, because Line 5 benefits Michigan as the line goes right to, as you heard from Patrick DeHaan, it goes right to Detroit. You know, it's a pretty big city. Michigan taking the oil to refine it into what we use to drive cars and heat homes. So the Line 5 discussion goes beyond what's happening in northern Wisconsin environmentally. It goes into what's happening in neighboring states. That matters for what happens internationally with regards to Canada and the oil to and from there. So, you know, it's a really heady topic. And I'm sure had I been able to keep him on longer, he's a busy guy. He gets interviewed by dozens of outlets a day, but had I kept him on longer, I would have asked more about that. And you know, if I'm guest hosting this show again in the post Christmas break, maybe I will talk to him again and just talk a little bit about that part of it. But really fascinating stuff. We do have a couple of stories already up on our websites. Depending on the station you're listening to, you can find it on those websites. It's on all of the stations that we're broadcasting on, but you know, for some, you have to tab into the news thing. Some of it's on the front page, but you can find it on the websites now, talking about today, just kind of referencing the weekend and the report that came out about the oil spill in Jefferson County, which again is in southeastern Wisconsin. It's east of Dane County. So you can find out more information at civicmedia.us if you don't want to go hunting around your local station website. So really, really good stuff. The other part on the oil and gas conversations is that it's not strictly limited to, you know, you or me filling up our car and going for a drive. I mean, this increase in fuel prices, decreases in fuel prices, as these things go up, they dip into budgets that are already burdened with the inflation of other things, other products, other services. So if fuel costs and transportation costs go up, then the cost of goods and shipping and food and stuff, it all goes up. So it is one of those things that, yeah, it changes, it fluctuates daily. That's why this tool at Gas Buddy exists, so you can track the coming and going of of all the gas prices and all the things. But, you know, at the same time, we're talking about a, you know, we're talking about how it impacts everything at large. And boy, you start getting into the oil pipelines and how they're all connected and how it's connected to international trade. You know, there's a book to be written, several books to be written on all of this, but it is nice to have a conversation with somebody who follows it all and can articulately, you know, explain what's happening here better than I could just reading and researching on my own. So a big thanks to Patrick in that last segment. Obviously, today has been, you know, a trying day in other regards. I think for anybody with kids in school, you know, you're going to hug them a little tighter tonight after a school shooting in Madison at Abundant Life Christian School. Claimed the lives of a few people, you know, several people hurt. It's just it's hard to see news stories like that. And, you know, today we're in the midst of planning this show's coverage and my role in sports and making sure we've got that planned for the week. And then this happens, you know, right around 11 o'clock this morning, and you kind of set it all aside. And, you know, for hours I was, you know, helping with the news coverage and the news team putting it together. But, you know, at the same time, there's a pit in my stomach because, you know, my kids literally at the time of it and until a few hours ago or a couple hours ago, you know, they were sitting in a classroom themselves. And, you know, it's a scary place right now for, as I said in the last hour, it's a scary place when you're, you know, when these things are happening so close to home. And I know for a lot of you that are listening in Madison on WMDX, you know, it's literally at home. It's not just close to home. It is home. And, you know, that's, you know, it's tough. It's so tough to deal with. And a lot of schools have put out statements offering support, mental health services for students, staff as well. But, you know, speaking of school stuff, you know, we're going to talk about a aspect of it that if you want to get involved in, you know, perhaps, you know, advocating for maybe more security or advocating for more mental health resources for students, now's the time to get on a school board because the election is in the spring and the deadline to get paperwork in is January 7th. And we're going to talk more about that in the next segment about how you can get on the ballot and be on a school board. You are listening to the Dom Salvia Show right here on Civic Media.
You're an organ donor, right? Well, here's a tragic fact. Approximately 20 people die each day waiting for precious donated organs. You could make a life-saving decision simply by getting that important dot on your driver's license. That little dot shows those who need to know that you've made a decision to donate organs at a critical time. Go to heroicdeed.com to learn more about the importance of organ donation and how you can make your wishes known. Talk to your family. Get the dot. Save lives. HeroicDeed.com.
Welcome back. It is the Dom Salvia Show here on Civic Media. I'm Jimmy Cuska. Thank you for joining us today. Going to head out to Nightlight with Pete Schwaba coming your way in a half an hour. But right now, going to take some time to talk about getting on the ballot, running for local election. And I'm speaking to this as a current school board member, and I am very happy to have our next guest on to talk about what it takes to get on the ballot as a school board member. I'm joined right now by Dan Rossmiller. He is the executive director of WASB. That's the Wisconsin Association of School Boards. And we are talking about how you, the listener, if you're interested in being on the school board, how you could do that. Dan, it's great to talk to you after just having a chance to see you here a couple months ago in southwestern Wisconsin.
Yeah, it's great to be on with you, Jimmy. Thanks for having me.
Well, as a current school board member myself, this is an area that I have a lot of interest in because this is a very important time of the year on the calendar. And this is the window in which if there's an open seat for school boards in Wisconsin and like a lot of local races, you have until January 7th to get your paperwork in. So I wanted to bring you on to talk about how people that are interested in being on the school board, how they can learn more, of course, but also how they can also get onto the board. But I want to start with that first part. So if people are
interested in being on the school board. There's a lot of reasons people might be interested in being a part of their local school board. And I think, you know, for me, my motivation was always, well, what can I do to help the kids in our area? I'm pretty new to the area I'm in, but my kids go to school here. So I have an interest in making sure that that things here are pretty cool for them. But if people are looking for, you know, resources, things like that, WASB's done a tremendous job, in my experience, of kind of laying that groundwork and providing materials for people to learn more about getting involved. So we'll start there. Where can people find information on how they might become part of a school board?
Well, I think the best place for people to start, and something that would apply to every school district, would be to talk to your school district office. Talk to the superintendent's office, and in particular, the administrative assistant in that office is likely the one that deals mostly with election issues. They should have information about the forms that you need to complete to get on the ballot, and could provide you with some information about how often the board meets, what the compensation is, if any, for board members. And just a little bit about the obligations that go along with the job. We do publish a guide for candidates. That's something that we make available to those administrative assistants and school board clerks. And they can provide you with a copy of that document. It's about 15 pages long, and it's a kind of a how-to. It's not really a how-to on how to run a successful campaign, but it's about being on the board and how you get elected to a school board.
In my mind, you know, you think of campaigns, you're thinking, we just went through this November election where we had, you know, these huge rallies and huge things like that. Well, for school board, in my experience, isn't quite that exciting. It's exciting. You don't have the thousands of people, you know, rallying me. Maybe you do. I don't know. Every school board's different. But in my experience in a small district, it hasn't been that way. But but more to the point, the candidates for local office still have to file paperwork in terms of campaign financing and things like that, right?
Yes, they do. Historically, school board is a nonpartisan office, which means the candidate does not run as a member of a political party. Now, that's not to say that political parties aren't getting involved in making endorsements and things like that. But as a nonpartisan race, it's elected on the April ballot with all of the other nonpartisan races, judges, the state superintendent of public instruction, and other local offices that are not also nonpartisan. And in order to get on the ballot, candidates have to file what's called a declaration of candidacy. And on that, that's something that they have to have notarized. So they'll have to find a notary. And typically there will be one in the school district office. They'll have to provide their name and address and basically swear that they're a candidate for office, and at the time that they complete that document, they're going to meet the applicable age, citizenship, residency, and voting qualifications and requirements, if any, that are prescribed by the state constitution and our state laws, and that they will otherwise qualify for office if nominated and elected. One of the things that they also have to attest to is that they've not been convicted of a felony in any court within the United States for which they have not been pardoned. That's a constitutional requirement in Wisconsin to run for local office. And they'll also indicate their name as they wish it to appear on the ballot. So you may, I don't know, but you may have, if you're known by Jimmy, you may have asked people to put your name on the ballot as Jimmy rather than James or something else.
Yep.
In addition to the declaration of candidacy, they'll also have to file a campaign finance registration statement. That's something, if you're going to spend any money on a race, you're going to have a separate bank account that's separate from your personal account, and you'll have to provide some information so that people will, if there needs to be an audit of any kind, that people could find that account and examine it. In some school districts, nomination papers are required. That's something that typically is decided on by the annual school board meeting, or the annual district meeting, rather. And typically it's not a lot. It's often 100 or fewer. Sometimes it's 20 or more. But the reason for having nomination papers is to ensure that individuals running for the school board can demonstrate that they have at least some support in the community. And those have to be circulated and filed with the other papers. And that deadline, again, is the first Tuesday in January, which this in 2025 falls on January 7th. So just wanted to add that. That's something that if the district you reside in requires that, you should know that in advance so that you get those signatures gathered. Those are rather technical requirements. I think the biggest thing is that people should be interested in students, making sure that students in your district are achieving at high levels and maximizing their potential. A lot of the focus in a school board is on student achievement. Some of the focus is on what I would call a quasi legislative focus. The school board makes policy for the district in a whole number of areas where the state or federal government hasn't already laid down the rules. And the school board leads and governs the schools and the educational programs. So the school board has particular control over curriculum and other kinds of matters, what types of courses are taken. So, for example, in a rural area, you might have an emphasis on ag education that you wouldn't have in a city, a big city, or you might have other kinds of career and technical education programs that are tailored to meet the needs of your local businesses and employers. And that's something that the school board gets to decide on. Really, that leadership role that I talked about is performed as part of a team, and that team includes the district administrator, sometimes referred to as a superintendent. I think that people I know who that run for school board find it a very rewarding experience. I've talked to a lot of parents who had the privilege of handing the high school diploma to their son or daughter, and just That's an experience of a lifetime, one that they'll never forget.
Talking to Dan Rossmiller from the Wisconsin Association of School Boards, he is the executive director there. I will say that for me, as a coach, being able to be up on the stage when the football players or the basketball players come across and getting that big bear hug, that is something that is probably the highlight of all of the school board stuff that I get to do here in my district. But that is certainly a tremendous reward for the work that goes into it. And, you know, there is work. It's not, you know, this isn't, you know, we're not building walls or putting up ceilings or anything like that. When I talk about work, but there is a lot of reading involved, and there are a ton of details involved that, as someone who is new to education and learning about this when I joined the board a few years ago, in my district, there's a lot of things you don't understand, the details that go into understanding or putting together plans for a district. I find that personally fascinating.
Yeah, it is very much that way. You know, people don't think about this, but in many communities, the school district may be the largest employer in the community, and it's subject to state and federal laws. You get into everything from employment laws to laws about discrimination, about educational performance, the certainly the taxing and spending laws, the requirements for going to referendum and all those kinds of things. And then there are the personnel type issues and the student when students misbehave and things like that. But there's a tremendous amount of it's always something new. There's a tremendous amount of variety in what you do as a school board member. Let me, Jimmy, talk a little bit. I mentioned kind of the qualifications that you need to run for school board. First off, you need to be a citizen of the United States. You have to be 18 years of age or older. We talked a little bit. You have to have no disqualifying prior criminal convictions. And you have to be a resident of the school district for at least 28 consecutive days at the time you file your declaration of candidacy. Now, in some school districts, relatively few around the state, school board members are elected to numbered seats where you don't run for the board against a field, but you run against the people who have declared their candidacy in that specific numbered district. In other districts, oftentimes when it's the result of consolidations in the past, and you can typically tell that by the names. I know here in the Madison area, we have Monona Grove, which is a consolidation of Monona and Cottage Grove. We have Middleton Cross Plains, which is a consolidation of, Middleton and Cross Plains, as the name suggests. When you have those types of different districts, very often you'll have what are called geographically apportioned areas. And to be a candidate, you'll have to reside within one of those specific geographic areas. And those are designed to make sure that all of the areas of a district are represented and not just the population center of the district, you know, the biggest community. So it's really designed to ensure fairness. But in all of these cases, all of the voters of the school district vote in that, you know, for that candidate in that election. So even if you have to live within a certain area, everybody who resides within the district and is a qualified elector votes in that election.
Well, you just explained my district where I'm at, which is Boscobel. Talking to Dan Rossmiller from the Wisconsin Association of School Boards. And just a quick thought here. You know, we talked about, you know, kind of the qualifications and things like that and going in. But, you know, other than that, when you talk about the very technical part of it, you don't necessarily need to have past educational experience to be on a school board. It's actually pretty broad in terms of that. And I would think that a lot of boards welcome some of that broad experience too from all different areas of life, whether it's, you know, somebody that's a first responder, somebody who's in construction, somebody like me who's in media. All these different backgrounds can certainly lend to some interesting perspectives on a school board.
I think the most important thing to think about is that school boards in Wisconsin and in the United States are relatively unique. They are locally elected by the community to represent the values and priorities within that community. They play a unique role in that they represent students, most of whom are not 18 years of age and don't have a vote. And they also represent the taxpayers in the communities. So one of their jobs is to make sure that the resources that are provided to schools are used in a responsible manner and in an accountable manner. And sometimes, you know, when it comes to setting budgets and other things, sometimes that includes a decision that perhaps not enough resources are being provided to the schools. And many, many districts, in fact, over half the districts in Wisconsin went to the voters with a referendum question this year. So that has become increasingly part of the job as well, making the case to the community for the resources to be provided to the schools.
Can you stick around just for a couple more minutes?
Sure.
Again, Dan Rossmiller from the Wisconsin Association of School Boards. We'll be heading to Nightlight coming up here in about 15 minutes. But first, we'll have more with Dan right on the other side of this. You're listening to the Dom Salvia Show on Civic Media.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
It's the Dom Salvia Show here on Civic Media. I'm Jimmy Cuska. Thank you for joining us. Coming up in 10 minutes, we send it off to Nightlight with Pete Schwabe. Right now, talking to Dan Rossmiller. He is the executive director of the Wisconsin Association of School Boards.
I wanted to follow up on a thought we had just before the break, and that was on the referendum question, because this is something that school boards are grappling with the past couple of years. Our school district, the one I'm in, passed a referendum to build facilities, but we are seeing a lot of them go up in this past year. A record-setting number of them, in fact, went on ballots in 2024. And, you know, there's a lot of reasons for this. School finance is something that you and I could probably do a whole show just on that part of it. It's been a favorite topic of mine in the podcast we've done with Busted Pencils and with some of the other shows that I've been on here at Civic Media. But I just to bring it back to the role of the school board in this, the referendum process to me was really interesting in the buildup to it, because it's not a you know, a couple of months, a couple of weeks decision. This is something that takes course over the course over a year in some cases between the surveying and exploring the need and looking at the budget. This is a process that takes some time before a question gets put on the ballot, right?
Yeah, definitely. It's not something that school boards take lightly. They give a considerable amount of thought to this, and it, you know, it impacts the taxpayers of the community. It impacts the students. It's about providing the kind of opportunities that the school board believes are needed to ensure that students are maximizing their potential. And, you know, just the mechanics of it, a school board has to pass a resolution to go to referendum 10 weeks before at least 10 weeks before the election. So right there, that's a significant amount of time. But before that even comes to a vote on a resolution, the questions are looking at the budget. You know, how much do we have in our budget? How much do we need to provide the kind of programs and services that are important to the students? And in many districts, that's a function of declining enrollment. We have revenue limits in Wisconsin. We've had them since the 93-94 school year, and they place a limit on how much a district can raise from property taxes and state aids. That's about probably between 75% and 80% of a school district's budget. And that each school district has a unique revenue limit per pupil. So you might find two school districts right next to each other. One has a dollar figure that's $2,000 per pupil higher than their neighbor. Clearly, they have an easier time attracting and retaining staff, including teachers, with that extra $2,000. If you think about a classroom of 15 to 20 kids, that's anywhere from $30,000 to $40,000 per classroom that they have above what their neighbor has available. So it's driven by a lot of things. It's driven by how much money the legislature provides and whether the legislature allows an adjustment in the revenue limit. In six of the past 13 years, the legislature has allowed no adjustment in the revenue limit, which means school districts cannot raise any more money than they raised in the previous year, despite inflation being a factor, particularly recently. And that was most acute in the 2022-23 school year, when inflation was at about 8% CPI. The consumer price index went up about 8% or more, and there was no allowable increase in what districts could spend. And they had increases in those costs just the same as individual consumers did. So, looking, I could get into the reasons, and I know you said that you've done many shows on school finance. You know, that's a big part of it. But looking at all those factors and looking at trying to anticipate what enrollments are going to look like in a year or two or three or four, trying to look at facilities needs and if you're not getting those increases, you delay certain maintenance and you might be able to patch the roof for a couple of years, but eventually you're going to have to replace that roof. And oftentimes that's the cause of districts having to go to referendum. Sometimes it's just that they need new facilities. We saw really good success this year with districts going to what are called capital referendums, referendums to build facilities. And it wasn't performing arts centers or athletic facilities that voters were approving. It was career and technical education facilities, labs for kids, really instructionally focused facilities that voters were approving. And that just shows, I think, that school boards rightly understood what the needs of their students are, and the public was receptive to that and also understood what those needs are and voted to approve those referendums. We had about 88% of our facilities referendums pass.
Dan, we are out of time in this show, and I feel like we could have just spilled right on into our next program. I kept talking about this because I still had more things I could have talked about on this. But in the meantime, having you on to talk about getting into school board and resources for it, it's a lot of great information for people. I know that everything from school finance and referendums to all the other things happening in education will be hot topics at the State Education Convention next month in Milwaukee. But for now, Dan, I thank you for your time. It's great to get this information out to people who are listening.
Thank you, Jimmy.
Thanks again, Dan. Dan Rossmiller, Wisconsin Association of School Boards. Big thanks to all the guests on today's show. That includes Patrick DeHaan of GusBuddy.com, who joined us earlier this hour. Also last hour, having Mike Shaw on from the College Football Bowl games here in Wisconsin. And a big shout out to Catherine Lake, our very own here at Civic Media, the WMDX Madison program director, who is out covering today the tragic events that happened in Madison. We'll have more coverage on that on our news side of things here on our Civic Media stations throughout the week. And a big thanks to our MVP of the program, as always, as well, Jess P.S. Thank you so much. Nightlight is next. I'm Jimmy Cuska. Thank you for listening today. Have a great evening, everybody.
The national news cycle never stops, but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.